or 101.9 and let the music pull you in.
Since its inception in 2022, CFRC Power Plays has become the number one destination for all things Queens football.
And that is a touchdown for the Gales!
With over 50 million lifetime views, CFRC Power Plays is the defining voice in Queens football coverage.
Looking for Nico Cuomo! Cuomo! My goodness! Nico Cuomo with a touchdown!
Follow us today on Instagram at CFRC Power Plays, your number one spot for rock solid football action.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine. You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome, everyone. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario.
This moment represents both a significant acceleration and an expansion of long-standing repressive tactics. I think there are continuities and some ruptures in that sense. And in the report, we make the argument that current counterterrorism measures in Europe replicate the logic of colonial emergency laws, which, as I mentioned before, were used to suspend rights and maintain imperial dominance. There is also a more contemporary legacy of state repression against Palestine solidarity in Europe and elsewhere, and I think long before October 2023 as well.
From Ashabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network, I am Yara Hawari, and this is Rethinking Palestine.
Since the start of the genocide in Gaza, European governments have escalated their instrumentalization of counter-terrorism measures to criminalize Palestine solidarity groups. From prescriptions to fabricating narratives around extremism, these efforts and more have made it increasingly clear that there is a pattern of repression that is being used to demobilize opposition to the Israeli genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. The European Legal Support Center, the ELSC, has published a new report detailing these efforts across Europe, and in particular in the UK, the Netherlands, Germany, and France. Joining us to discuss the findings of this report is Amira Hala. Amira is the research officer at the ELSC and the lead author of this new report. She holds a PhD in international relations, where her research focused on how ideas of normal and deviant behavior are used as tools of authoritarianism. Amira, thank you for joining us on this episode of Rethinking Palestine.
Thanks for having me, Yara.
So I think many of our listeners will be aware that the Palestinian struggle for liberation and the solidarity movement has long been ludicrously smeared as terrorism in an effort to crush it, but also to dissuade those from joining in efforts. Could you give us a bit more background on this and bring us up to this current moment?
Yeah, absolutely. So the terrorism tag against the Palestinian struggle for liberation has been mobilized by the so-called West since at least the 1930s. And so that would require us to go a bit back in time to the Palestinian revolt that started in 1936 against Zionist presence in Palestine. And also in its later phases, it targeted the British presence in Palestine. And at the time, specifically in 1937, not only did the British Mandate Authority in Palestine outlaw the Higher Arab Committee and the Regional Arab National Committee, which at the time constituted this sort of the entire organized urban structure movement, and they were the ones who had initially called for civil disobedience. But the British Mandate also appointed a chief advisor on terrorism and policing in Palestine. And this person was Charles Tigart, appointed in November 1937. And, you know, his big ideas included building about 70 concrete fortresses at all the main lookout posts across the country. And he also had this kind of huge wire fence put up along the 80-kilometer border with Lebanon and Syria. And all of this was done to try and stop foreign weapons and fighters from getting in and any kind of support for the revolt in Palestine from reaching Palestinians. And this whole strategy was also basically just using a playbook that he himself had written from his time dealing with anti-colonial rebellions up in northern India. And so in this report that we recently published, we make the connection between today's framing of Palestinians and Palestine solidarity as terrorism, as well as the colonial logic of emergency rule that acted as the legal veneer for suspending rights. And so I guess it's also important to note here that the repressive modalities that were used by Britain against Palestinians during the 1936 revolt, or those by France against Algerians in Algeria and by Germany in Namibia and so on, these kinds of modalities were never really purely colonial inventions. And so this is obviously very relevant to today's banning and proscription of Palestine solidarity groups in Europe. These modalities of repression themselves also emerge from a back and forth between metropole and colony. So they form a kind of a connected history of controlling populations both at home and abroad. But that's, of course, not to deny that the intensity and legal permissibility of violence were, of course, undoubtedly greater in the colonial sphere. But essentially, it's the underlying doctrines of surveillance, population control, and categorizing groups as so-called internal enemies. These things were developed and refined through this kind of constant exchange between between the metropole and the colonial contexts. And I think that it's important also, I think, to note that this long history of figuring anti-colonial resistance as terrorism is what really makes this framing of Palestinians and their allies as terrorists so powerful. It is what makes it stick with some people, what makes it believable to them in a way. So it's because essentially this long history is why this notion of terrorism is powerful propaganda, or more accurately, a powerful propaganda tool for imperialism. And it's also a tool that is constantly being updated. So if you think about the ways in which it was revived, this kind of tool of tagging people as terrorists, it was revived in the wake of the 9/11 attacks, for example, or in 2013 onwards against the backdrop of the rise of ISIL. In each of these instances and other instances, its entire Muslim and Arab populations are presented as innately hateful, aggressive, irrational, and so on. And these are, of course, not just recent in 9/11 or 2013. These are very old colonial representations and understandings of colonized subjects and especially of Arabs. So in a way, Arabs have all these excesses, right? So one important one is the love of violence for the sake of violence. But at the same time, these colonized subjects in general and, you know, those who were particularly in Southwest Asia and North Africa, so SWANA, were also presented at the same time as having these violent excesses. They were also presented as kind of lacking something. So that something is usually, you know, and we hear this all the time, unfortunately, until today. So lacking civilization, lacking capacity to develop modern sensibilities. And of course, the latter is includes the capacity to self-govern. And so from these competing logics of excess and lack, Arabs and others in SWANA, according to Western imperial powers, of course, cannot therefore have any meaningful revolutions, because by their or our very nature, and I am Arab myself, they or we are unable to value freedom, justice, democracy, and all these things that the West purports are theirs or their kind of inventions. And so what they can do, however, these kind of quote unquote backward, undevelopable populations in SWANA, what they can do, what we can do, and what they do and what we do when we rise up is basically terrorism and not legitimate resistance. And so today, not only have European and more generally Western governments, of course, branded resistance in Palestine as terrorism, but they are also using so-called counterterrorism measures to ban Palestine groups, or rather, sorry, Palestine solidarity groups in Europe. And why is that? The most obvious reason is obviously to silence the massive public opposition to the genocide and to protect their own complicity. And this has been a coordinated effort between governments, Zionist lobby groups, and arms manufacturers who have a financial stake in all of this. But they also have, these European and Western governments, an interest in maintaining the notion that Palestinian resistance and Palestine solidarity constitute terrorism and are, of course, also, quote unquote, externally funded and encouraged by, let's say, Iran, not for the purposes of liberation. So it's important for these European governments, European states, Western states, to make it seem as though Palestinians, for example, are not resisting because they are colonized, but because there is some sort of external pressure on them to do so, or there is a financial motivation because somewhere like Iran, for example, gives them the money to do that. And so they're not doing it for the purpose of liberation, but for merely orchestrating chaos. And so this allows the West to appear civilized against all these kinds of allegedly barbaric others, and positions the Israeli ethno-nationalist and settler colonial project as necessary against the so-called Islamic terror. And so this is precisely where the myth that the Zionist entity is the quote-unquote only democracy in the Middle East comes from.
Amira, it's really interesting that you started nearly 100 years ago, because I think most people would think to start post 9/11 and the so-called war on terror era, which is where we see the use of the notion of terrorism really on steroids. So I think it's really important to recognize that this is something that has been used and weaponized against people of the East, and in particular Muslims and Arabs, for nearly the last century.
Absolutely, it has been. And, you know, as I said, it's not just about Palestine or Palestinians, although it's important for us to also specify exactly how this happens to Palestine and Palestinians. But as I said, it's coming directly from the colonial playbook, right? So it's and it's been used also in the heart of Europe itself to basically halt resistance, even resistance that has a lot to do just with internal struggles. So, for example, struggles in Britain for democracy and republicanism, very similar tactics have been used against dissenters decades ago.
So given this extensive history that you briefly laid out for us, what is so distinct about this moment in the repression? Or is it merely an acceleration of repression?
I think this moment represents both a significant acceleration and an expansion of long-standing repressive tactics. I think there are continuities and some ruptures in that sense. And in the report, we make the argument that the current counterterrorism measures in Europe replicate the logic of colonial emergency laws, which, as I mentioned before, were used to suspend rights and maintain imperial dominance. But there is also a more contemporary legacy of state repression against Palestine solidarity in Europe and elsewhere, and I think long before October 2023 as well. And even at the ELSC, we were established in 2019 because there already had been a gap in defending and supporting Palestine solidarity activists and organizations in Europe. And long before 2023 and long before 2019, when we were established, we see the kind of big definitions of terrorism and how they've been used as a tool of state control, and also relying predominantly on the racist tropes I mentioned before. Their reliance on this and their reliance of these big definitions, they used predominantly to go after those who express solidarity with Palestine. And these include activists, all of this also prior to 2023. This includes activists, academics, journalists, students, doctors, and the list goes on. It's like encompassing all and anyone who expresses, even just in words, solidarity with Palestinians. And this is, of course, is always happening in conjunction with using the allegation that Palestinians and anyone who supports them are anti-Semitic. The labels of terrorism and anti-Semitism, I think, work really well together for the purposes of this kind of imperial state propaganda. And we see, especially in more recent times, that, you know, while European countries have actual organized neo-Nazi movements who openly express anti-Jewish racism and who constitute a real threat to both Jews and Muslims, they are rarely ever branded terrorist or even criminal. And there is this kind of implicit assumption that maybe their racism is grown out of disillusionment or ignorance. But when it comes to Palestinians and other Arabs, their slash our alleged innate violent nature makes it so that they are always going to be hateful and extremist. And anyone in solidarity with them, with Palestinians, especially if that person is white, they're either merely brainwashed or naive. And that's, of course, according to state propaganda. But this has not been working as it had in the past, obviously, as we see the increasing awareness around settler colonialism in Palestine. And gradually, and even before October 2023, Palestinians, whether in Gaza or elsewhere in Palestine, have been able to show us a lot more clearly now that they have some access to the outside world through social media, for example. And it's important to note that this access had been completely denied in the past. And now, of course, we see attempts at restricting it over and over again. But nevertheless, they have been able to show us what settler colonialism, ethno-nationalism, and Jewish supremacism look like in real time. So I would say that the escalating response, in part, is because more and more people are learning the truth and more often than not taking action against the Zionist project. But I think, of course, that October 7, 2023 constituted this really important moment for the West to update yet again the racist tropes around the innately violent and lacking and therefore terrorist Arab. So they wanted to make sure that Palestinians are never seen as freedom fighters. They didn't want anyone from direct action groups to academics to legitimately and convincingly discuss Palestinian anti-colonial resistance. And the thing is that, you know, there is a lot of work by these imperial governments that goes into framing the struggle for Palestinian liberation as terrorist. It is not something that comes naturally to the outside observer, because simply anyone who has access to an internet connection can easily understand the reality of what is going on. And the closer the Palestinians get to liberation, the more the work that needs to go into distorting that struggle, and the more the repression. And so in the report, we show that the current moment marks a somewhat distinct acceleration, in the sense that there had been a systematic and coordinated prescription across Europe in multiple countries. And so these countries, specifically we focus on Germany, Britain, and France and the Netherlands, although the prescriptions have not fully happened in all the countries, only in Germany and Britain, but it's very much evident that they are in the process of doing so. And of course, a significant escalation we find in the past 2 years is the pivot from charging activists under standard criminal law to using terrorism legislation, which of course has lower evidentiary thresholds and bypasses judicial oversight. And as I said, this kind of vague definitions of terrorism mean that governments can stretch it to mean whatever they want. So now it's being used to target protesters, to criminalize slogans like "from the river to the sea," and to go after online speech. But I think that the most distinct thing about this moment is also the growing strength of the movement. I don't think that Palestine Solidarity or the Palestine Solidarity movement had ever been this big and this powerful. And this simply means that the repression will accelerate and expand. And I think this is a very critical moment for all of us who are fighting for liberation and against genocide to really commit ourselves not to be afraid of what has happened and what is coming.
If you're enjoying this podcast, please visit our website, al-shabaka.org, where you will find more Palestinian policy analysis and where you can join our mailing list and donate to support our work.
Amira, thanks for that. I think one of your last points is really important, that solidarity activism has always been repressed, but through the use of terrorism legislation, authorities are now able to target many more people with much less so-called evidence. And this means that the repression can be far more widespread. People have a tendency to dismiss this as, you know, something that's okay, maybe getting a little bit worse, but I don't think they fully realize what this kind of legislation actually enables authorities to do, which is far more than they've ever been able to do before.
And I agree with you, but also it's not just that it enables these governments, these authorities to do a lot more, but I think it also, returning to a point I made in the beginning, it's that this label of terrorism is really convenient also as a way to convince others who are on the fence or who may not be so interested that, oh yeah, these people, whether those who are in organized direct action groups like Palestine Action or simply people who are just marching down the street saying free Palestine, it gives them the idea that, yeah, these people are terrorists. Of course they are. And it's, as I said, it's so easy for people to believe that because terrorism has had this really long history. And it's like people have successfully been conditioned to understand Palestine, to understand Arabs, to understand Muslims, to understand others with a big O in these specific terms. And these specific terms stick because of their history, but not just because of their history, because they keep being updated over and over again. So you mentioned 9/11, right? So, and there were moments prior to 9/11 as well. You know, so there are so many instances where this is updated and reinforced, hammered into the brains of the general public. And I think that's why terrorism, whether legislation or just discourse, is very powerful in that sense. But I think also at the same time, is slowly but surely being kind of challenged.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think it's been very effective, especially in the last 2 years, but perhaps even more, the ability of the solidarity movement to push back against that kind of narrative of framing, not just about Palestine, but beyond, has also increased. And I think because out of necessity. Amira, I'm wondering if you could share some of the case studies that this report you worked on looked at.
Yeah, of course. So as I said, the report focuses on four main countries that the ALSC has worked on for years and where we see this tool of prescription being used or potentially going to be used. But today I'll focus on two case studies specifically. So the recent prescription of the Direct Action Group, Palestine Action in the UK, and then also the kind of really imminent threat of dissolution of the group Urgence Palestine in France. And excuse my French. So first, let's talk about Palestine Action in the UK. Palestine Action describes itself as being committed to ending global participation in the Israeli genocide against Palestinians. And their primary method is direct action. So this means specifically targeting the facilities and assets of Elbit Systems, which is the largest Israeli weapons manufacturer, and which is, of course, profiting or has been profiting from the murder, maiming, and displacement of Palestinians for the past 2 years, but not only. And for 5 years, Palestine Action has conducted a campaign against businesses and institutions that are complicit in the continued colonization of Palestine. And they, of course, escalated their actions significantly after the beginning of this genocide in October 2023. And for years, and as kind of we alluded to before, activists faced standard criminal charges for their actions, like trespass or criminal damage, and were often acquitted by juries. And so even since October 2023, actionists from Palestine Action have often been acquitted by juries once jury heard why they're doing what they're doing. But in a significant and dangerous escalation, the UK government moved to prescribe. So that basically means just outright ban the group Palestine Action as a terrorist organization using the Terrorism Act of the year 2000. And they did so in July 2025, so only a few months ago. And this designation really constitutes, despite all the escalating repression anyway, this designation specifically constitutes a really seismic shift. It means that now, not just carrying out actions, like direct action against, property owned by weapons manufacturers and others, but even expressing support for the group. So, for example, holding a sign that says, I support Palestine Action, or sharing a post, this can lead not only to just arrest, but arrest under counterterrorism powers, which has far more severe implications than any, than other forms of arrest or charges. And it's interesting, but really, really sad, and that the government did this really interesting thing where they bundled the vote on this ban. So the vote in parliament to ban Palestine Action, they bundled it with those of two neo-Nazi groups. So they bundled it with the ban or the vote on a ban of two other neo-Nazi groups. So you have two neo-Nazi groups. One of them is like, I think it's called murder cult something. I apologize, I don't remember the exact name, but these two words were in the title. And so these two neo-Nazi groups were bundled with Palestine Action, which forced Parliament to approve all three at once without specific debate. Maybe not forced Parliament, but prompted Parliament rather, because I know that many MPs also wanted to prescribe Palestine Action. It's not like they had to do this against their will. And so in the report, we outline that the Terrorism Act of 2000 is particularly dangerous because its broad definition of terrorism criminalizes even politically motivated property damage and treats political motivation as a core component of terrorism. And so in a way, this act effectively insulates government policy from any meaningful challenge or scrutiny. And, the prescription of Palestine Action is also not really about property damage. We see a long-standing tradition of the use of direct action in protest in Britain and in Europe, in British and European history, which included, this direct action included property damage as well. And it is a tactic used by many celebrated protest movements throughout history, and in Britain, specifically the suffragettes in the early 20th century, and their actions that also damage property are, especially today, very widely celebrated as this like really important feminist thing that happened, which it was. But in contrast, you know, Palestine actions, property damage is terrorism. And so the prescription is really about neutralizing a group that effectively targets the arms trade, supporting and enabling genocide. But it's also about signaling to the public that Palestine solidarity is terrorism. So regardless of whether or not you are in Palestine action. And a judicial review of the prescription was granted by the High Court. That was on July 30th, 2025. And the court acknowledged that it is, quote, reasonably arguable, end quote, that the ban interferes with freedom of expression, and that the Home Secretary who made the decision to ban, her name is Yvette Cooper, may have had the duty to consult the group before imposing the prescription. But despite this, the court denied interim relief, which means that the ban remains in effect until at least November 2025, when the judicial review is probably going to take place. And so this means that any support for Palestine action remains criminalized. Now, looking at France, we have the case of Urgence Palestine, and this is a collective that formed in October 2023, mobilizing for, quote, Palestinian self-determination, end quote. And in April 2025, the French Interior Minister initiated proceedings to dissolve the group using sweeping administrative powers and stated that this was necessary to, quote, strike the Islamists. And so, you know, don't be so confused by the terminology, dissolution, ban, prescription. There are kind of slightly different legal frameworks that govern each, but ultimately the effect is the same. And the French government accused Urgence Palestine of, quote, advocating for a terrorist organization and, quote, provoking hatred against Jews. And then, you know, you see this over and over again, this link between terrorism and kind of anti-Jewish racism always coming up in discourse. But importantly, and as groups like, for example, Amnesty International warned, this move could have a massive chilling effect. And this move could also deter all sorts of solidarity actions and anti-racism work in France. And this kind of dissolution action, like many other legal frameworks, utilizes France's sweeping administrative powers under the Internal Security Code, which basically allows the Council of Ministers to dissolve any association by decree for vaguely defined reasons, such as provoking hatred or engaging in actions that, quote, likely to provoke terrorism. And so you can see how that can be interpreted in very broad terms. And obviously, as with other cases, this process also bypasses standard criminal proceedings and due process. And what is particularly alarming here is that is the process. And even before a dissolution decree was officially issued, the French government, for example, froze the assets of a spokesperson for Urgence Palestine. And this is a measure taken without any criminal conviction or even charges against the person. And I think that the threat to dissolve Urgence Palestine must also be understood to be part of a broader surge in dissolutions under current President Macron, which have in the past targeted Muslim civil society groups, anti-fascist collectives, and anti-capitalist organizations. And so I think overall, these kind of two cases, but also other cases in the report, essentially constitute the securitization of solidarity. This is really what we see happening in a kind of a coordinated Europe-wide effort and also beyond Europe, although we didn't really write about the US in that report, but we can see many parallels. And we see the use of administrative tools and counterterrorism measures to bypass judicial oversight and, you know, criminalize resistance to genocide and colonialism. And of course, you know, portraying solidarity as an existential threat to national security, which is precisely what this kind of label of terrorism does, is again another very powerful tool for controlling the population and maintaining the status quo in Palestine.
So I know a bit about the impact in the UK following the prescription of Palestine action, and I think it's not at all what the authorities expected. I don't think they anticipated the pushback and the fact that hundreds of people, literally hundreds of people, would be willing to put themselves at risk of arrest just to continue voicing their support for the group. And this this is because of, you know, massive pushback on a civil disobedience level. It's very organized. But there's also pushback on a legal level. You know, there's an ongoing effort to overturn the prescription. But I think this has also had undoubtedly a negative impact on the wider Palestine solidarity movement. What are you seeing on your side?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, at ELSC, one of the main things we do is we support and defend Palestine solidarity activists and advocates. And so we have seen since October 2023, but also since the ban on Palestine Action and other organizations in other countries, we've seen a surge in incidents being reported to us. And as you said, that's, you're right, you know, the prescription and kind of the securitization of Palestine solidarity groups have had a significant but also intentional chilling effect on the broader movement. Because ultimately, unlike what these governments claim, this is about suppressing resistance to genocide and criminalizing basic tactics of solidarity. This is about creating widespread confusion and fear amongst people. And it's very clear to us, and you know, I hope it's clear to many others, and I think it is, that this is a tool to target the wider movement, that prescription is a tool to target the wider movement. It's not just about Palestine Action in Britain. It's not just about Samadun in Germany. It's not just about Urgence Palestine. It's not about, you know, so and so and so. And there have been, as you said, you know, many, many arrests connected to the prescription. And so, for example, recently, I mean, maybe last month or something like that, a protester in Kent was threatened by armed police. So Kent in the UK was threatened by armed police for holding a sign that read Free Gaza. And officers were claiming that this phrase itself could be interpreted as support for the now prescribed Palestine Action. And so you see that this ban is leveraged to suppress even basic expressions of support for Palestine. And already, as you said, the UK has seen hundreds of arrests since the prescription of Palestine Action. And these are people who are merely holding protest signs reading, "I oppose genocide, I support Palestine Action." They were taken in the hundreds by police in custody. And so, as I said, the primary goal of these bans is to intimidate the broader public and deter from participating in solidarity actions. And this widespread and confusion about what the bans mean in practice is intentional. And like even recently, even before the prescription or the dissolution of Urgence Palestine in France, so, you know, it hasn't happened yet, but even just the discourse about banning it, Amnesty International, for example, has warned that this dissolution of groups like Urgence Palestine in France would have a, quote, deterrent effect on all individuals and organizations engaged on solidarity actions with the Palestinian people. And so this is a key impact of prescriptions. They are in themselves designed to paralyze political organizing and enforce silence in the face of genocide. But the repression also extends beyond formal bans into everyday surveillance and particularly targeting Muslim communities and activists. And these are kind of the precursors to the prescriptions and the bans. They are the real kind of the heart of the work of this kind of counterterrorism framework. And so, for example, in the UK, you see the Prevent strategy. So this is a kind of a pre-criminal counterterrorism arm of the state established in 2003 with stated purpose of stopping people from becoming terrorists or supporting terrorism. And this happens through the Prevent program by identifying and intervening with individuals deemed at risk of so-called radicalization. And so basically, this pre-criminal counterterrorism arm mandates, for example, that teachers, doctors, social workers report political expression. So such as displaying Palestine flags or chanting for an end to genocide, they report them as potential radicalization. And that's encouraged even before October 2023. And between October 2023 and January 2024, just in that really brief period, it's been reported that over 100 school children and students in the UK faced Prevent referrals for supporting Palestine. And, you know, universities are also major sites of securitization. So, you know, Palestine solidarity activism is heavily monitored as a potential security threat. So, for example, at Leiden University in the Netherlands, and since 2023, counterterrorism measures transformed the campus into this kind of surveillance zone with undercover guards and ID checks, and also very ridiculously framing academic subjects like conflict studies as potential vectors of terrorism and militant activism. And this is really like this institutional paranoia really also mirrors precisely what's happening with the prevent strategy in the UK, for example, and, you know, something that treats political engagement with Palestine as inherently suspect. Another impact that we're seeing on the rise now specifically, and so, you know, you find that repression not only escalates and accelerates, but also expands, right? And so right now we're seeing, for example, the rise on of entry bans. Migration and movement across borders is really impacted. So, for example, in the Netherlands prevented Salmedoun's Europe's coordinator from speaking at a Dutch university. And of course, Salmedoun, Palestine Prisoners Network, was banned in Germany already in 2023. And maybe, hopefully not, but maybe other countries will potentially follow suit, other European countries banning Salmedoun as well. And Salmedoun is one of the case studies we also write about in the report. And finally, we also see a pattern where states and intelligence agencies, it's as though they do it in kind of stages. So first, there is this stigmatization and securitization of solidarity in political declarations and then kind of general media discourse, which then legitimizes surveillance. And then that finally outlaws the groups entirely. So, for example, the German Domestic Intelligence Service labeled Salmedoun as extremist, which then granted authorities greater power to survey activists. But then similarly, the boycott, divestment and sanctions, the BDS movement, has also in Germany been branded as, quote, secular Palestinian extremism, which also paves the way for future bans. And so you can see that this impact, and, you know, these are just a few examples. There's house raids, there is intimidation, there is sneering, there is all sorts of things. That the impact on the wider movement is really kind of multi-pronged and really goes far beyond targeting specific organizations. It's all about creating a hostile environment for any form of Palestine solidarity by, you know, criminalizing groups, speech, symbols, embedding surveillance in public institutions like schools and universities, and of course, using administrative and powers and counterterrorism measures to intimidate and silence activists.
Amira, you mentioned the work of the ELSC in the movement and what they're doing to counter these repressive moves. But what can individuals do in the face of this increasing authoritarianism?
I think for me, on a kind of a personal level, but I think also at a movement level, the answer will always be organized collective resistance, and one that also importantly transcends borders and rejects these kinds of criminalizations that are taking place. And there is so much to learn kind of transnationally. And this was also one of the reasons why we wanted to do this report and you know, kind of apply this transnational framework to our work to show people, to show activists and others who are interested that these are these patterns. There are these patterns, there are these kind of coordinated efforts, but there are also these kind of telling signs of what enable us to predict what could happen. And I think collective organizing, collective resistance, learning from each other across borders is really important, not just across borders within Europe, but also those who have for the longest time been resisting authoritarianism elsewhere outside of the West entirely. And I would like to read you a short concluding paragraph from the report, which I think really encapsulates the spirit of our work at the LSC and also in general in the report, and in the report in particular. So, quote, "The escalating crackdown on Palestine solidarity across Europe is not inevitable. It is a challenge to be met with unity. The use of anti-terror measures and other mechanisms of repression show us the fragility of power, how fiercely it clings to silence, and how easily it unravels when confronted by organized resistance. The bans, raids, and prosecutions detailed here are not signs of the movement's weakness, but of its growing strength," end quote. So this means that if you're able to continue organizing and protesting, commit yourself and encourage others to commit themselves to solidarity work, because without it, we would be enabling and ignoring genocide and supremacy. And, you know, more specific to the report, as I said, it is important to outline this pattern so that the movement is able to recognize when further bans are about to happen, for example, and hopefully this will enable them to resist them. And, you know, we are also seeing signs, some signs that the tool of prescription may be replicated in places like Belgium, Italy, and Austria. So not just the kind of the four focus countries in the report. And in the report, we also end with a section that provides some useful resources. And these include, for example, some material on what to do during house raids, toolkits from campaigns that support victims of racist police violence, tools for requesting personal information from domestic intelligence agencies to challenge surveillance. So it's important to keep pushing with whatever means we have at our disposal. And of course, we at the LSC and many others like us use the kind of very limited pushback that the law offers to challenge these prescriptions. So, for example, you know, the example of Palestine Action, we're trying to change this prescription and to challenge it in court. But the law is never going to be our salvation, essentially. So, as I said, continue organizing and mobilizing against genocide. And importantly, also, if you ever get in trouble, please reach out to the ELSC and report any incidents of repression.
Amira, thank you so much. We'll leave it there, but we hope to have you on another episode of Rethinking Palestine very soon.
Thanks, Yara. Thanks for having me.
During a White House meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, President Trump unveiled a 20-point plan to end Israel's war on Gaza, free Israeli hostages, and remove Hamas from power. On Monday, Netanyahu expressed support for the deal, but he's already backed away from key elements. Hamas has not responded yet to the deal. The Palestinian Authority and several Arab countries have expressed support for Trump's proposal. As part of his 20-point peace plan, Trump announced the establishment of an international transitional governing body.
For the success of this effort, my plan calls for the creation of a new international oversight body, the Board of Peace, we call it, the Board of Peace, sort of a beautiful name, the Board of Peace, which will be headed not at my request, believe me, I'm very busy, but we have to make sure this works. The leaders of the Arab world and Israel and everybody involved asked me to do this, so it would be headed by a gentleman known as President Donald J. Trump of the United States. And we're going to put leaders from other countries on, and leaders that are very distinguished leaders, and we'll have a board, and one of the people that wants to be on the board is the UK former Prime Minister, Tony Blair, good man, very good man. Hamas and other terrorist factions will play no role in the board, but they'll play no role in the governance of Gaza at all, directly or indirectly.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke after President Trump.
I support your plan to end the war in Gaza, which achieves our war aims. It will bring back to Israel all our hostages, dismantle Hamas's military capabilities, end its political rule, and ensure that Gaza never again poses a threat to Israel.
Trump's plan outlines steps that could lead to a, quote, credible pathway to Palestinian self-determination and statehood, unquote. But after the meeting, Netanyahu said he would, quote, forcibly resist, unquote, Palestinian statehood. Netanyahu has also rejected the plan's call for Israel to eventually pull its troops fully out of Gaza. The two men ultimately refused to take questions after their joint statements yesterday at the White House. We're joined right now by Diana Bhutu, a Palestinian human rights attorney, former advisor to the negotiating team of the Palestine Liberation Organization, speaking to us from Ramallah. Thanks so much for being with us, Diana. Can you respond to what has been put forward and President Trump being the head of this, what they're calling a Board of Peace, with Tony Blair, one of the key players in this, the former British Prime Minister?
Well, this plan that has been put forward is certainly not a plan that is going to end the genocide. What they're simply attempting to do is repackage it. And the reason that I say this is that what Israel wants is to be able to get the Israelis back, but there is no guarantee whatsoever that they're going to stop the killing of Palestinians in any way, shape, or form. Instead, what we see is that this is a plan in which Israel will continue to have the ability to continue to attack Palestinians, to continue to take over Palestinian land, to continue to attack Palestinian hospitals, schools, and so on, with absolutely no oversight and no accountability internationally or otherwise. And the idea that this is being called a peace plan is not only a farce, but is an insult to anybody who actually believes in peace.
And Diana, the proposals talk about the creation of an international stabilization force that would take over from the Israeli military the security of Gaza, but no clear sense of how this force would be created and who the United States would apparently control it. Could you talk about that as well?
Yes, certainly. This plan is actually very, very, very vague. And one of the things that comes out of it is that, to me, it looks as though it's an Israeli plan that has been repackaged as being an American plan. And I say this because there were no Palestinians who were consulted in the creation of this plan. In fact, it was just Trump who discussed it with Arab leaders and then Trump discussing it with Netanyahu. He didn't meet with the Palestinian president. In fact, he didn't even allow him to travel to the United States for the UN General Assembly meeting. And so there's nothing in there where there's any form of Palestinian agency. So they talk about some sort of international force, but it's not at all clear. But more than that, when they're talking about the plan calls for the Israelis to withdraw in stages. But again, at no point is there any guarantee that the Israelis will actually withdraw. All of the guarantees that are mentioned in this document are guarantees that are given to Israel. There's not a single guarantee that is given to Palestinians. So once again, rather than this being a document that is leading to the end of Israel's genocide, it's actually just a repackaging of it. And so this is my fear, is that everybody wants to see an end to this genocide. And this is why you see so many people who have said that they welcome this plan. But the part two of this plan is the part where it is terrifying, where we're going to see that rather than there being Palestinian agency, instead, the very people who have carried out this genocide, the very people who have funded this genocide, are going to be the ones who are going to be in charge of Palestinian lives. And that's America and the United States.
Also, the proposal supposedly recognizes, quote, the aspirations of the Palestinian people for their own independent state. But as it's been made clear by Netanyahu, he will oppose that. So how do you accept the plan, but at the same time reject the key aspect of what the entire struggle of the Palestinian people has been for?
This is why this is an Israeli proposal that has just been repackaged as into an American one. And so he's made it clear that he never wants to see a Palestinian state. He's said this for decades. I just don't know why people don't believe him. And now he's said it very clearly, and the Americans have also said it very clearly, that they're not going to see a Palestinian state either. Once again, what we're seeing is that the Americans and the Israelis, the two parties that have been involved in carrying out this genocide, are going to be the people who are going to rule over the lives of the people over whom they've committed this genocide. And that is a recipe for disaster. I don't know why this is where the world has allowed this to stand. Why is it that Palestinians have been forced to negotiate an end to their genocide? This doesn't make any sense.
Can you talk about the role of the Arab countries, the Gulf countries? You have Netanyahu, apparently, with President Trump, calling the prime minister of Qatar and apologizing for bombing Doha, for violating its sovereignty, and killing—they were something like six people killed, but apologizing for killing the Qatari security officer. And then Trump now announcing that there's a deal being made between Israel, Qatar, and the United States, what that is. And, of course, it's in Qatar where the Hamas officials, apparently, are going to weigh— apparently as early as today, this deal. The last time they were weighing a U.S. deal, Israel bombed them, though didn't kill the major figures there.
Yes. So this apology was hardly an apology. The fact that it took President Trump to get Netanyahu to make a half-hearted apology. And I think that one of the reasons that Netanyahu didn't take any questions yesterday was because he didn't want to answer the question of whether he indeed apologized to Qatar. But it's not just a question of an apology. This isn't the first time that Israel has violated the territorial integrity of a country. Israel has been bombing Lebanon. It's been bombing Syria. It has been bombing Yemen. It has been bombing Tunisia. And it's been bombing Iran and, of course, Qatar as well. And so the fact that Israel's been allowed to get away with it is the part that is the most disturbing. This is the whole point of the international legal system, is that there should be methods to hold Israel to account. But once again, we see that the United States is giving cover to Israel. And this time, it's not just giving cover to it, but you see that it's giving cover to it in such a way that it's just simply an apology and that's it.
This is Democracy Now! On Friday, we were in the streets outside the United Nations. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now! Inside the United Nations today, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gave his address to the UN General Assembly. This is a part of what he said.
The final remnants of Hamas are holed up in Gaza City. They vow to repeat the atrocities of October 7th again and again and again, no matter how diminished their forces. That is why Israel must finish the job. That is why we want to do so as fast as possible.
As Netanyahu spoke, scores of delegates walked out of the UN General Assembly. This week, Western countries like Britain and Australia, France, Portugal, Canada, Belgium, and others joined more than 150 other countries in recognizing the state of Palestine. That leaves only the United States on the UN Security Council not to have recognized Palestine. Outside the UN today, thousands protested Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Up, up with liberation!
Up, up with liberation!
No, no, with occupation!
I'm Nazisa. I'm with the Palestinian Youth Movement, and we're here to demand the arrest of Netanyahu, the wanted war criminal, and to demand an arms embargo on Israel for its genocide against Palestinians. Well, you know, he's not going to come to the UN without meeting the resistance of this city. You know, and we're seeing, you know, that now we even have a mayoral candidate who's saying that if he's elected mayor, he won't allow Netanyahu to set foot in this city without arresting him. And so we're seeing the growing international isolation of Netanyahu, his bloc, and Israel, and that's what we're here to solidify. Symbolic rejection of Netanyahu isn't enough. Turning their backs on Netanyahu isn't enough. They need to take action as member states of the United Nations and impose real sanctions, an arms embargo, and a trade embargo on Israel.
My name is Reed Brody. I'm an international war crimes prosecutor. Benjamin Netanyahu has been indicted by the International Criminal Court for war crimes, crimes against humanity, for using starvation as a weapon of war. He is a fugitive from justice. States that are parties to the ICC have a duty to arrest him, and even states like the United States, which aren't parties, have a duty to arrest a war criminal. The United States is complicit in the war crimes being committed in Israel. The bombs that are being used to destroy Palestinian homes and schools and houses are American bombs. The campaign of extermination that Israel is carrying out is being done with American political support. The United States should be arresting him, not saving him.
My name is Nida Alafi. I'm a member of the Palestinian Youth Movement, and I'm here with the thousands of people to say, you know, Netanyahu should not be at the UNGA. Actually, he should be tried for his crimes at The Hague. And, you know, we're all here the same way we have been for the past 2 years, demanding that governments and leaders take real action to end the genocide that has only escalated, right? For it to have reached this level of atrocities and for him to still have a spot at the UNGA is absolutely egregious. And that's why I think now more than ever, people are more agitated. People are more angry. I mean, we see in Italy, you know, millions of people have gone on strike, right? And here the streets are filled with thousands of people when Netanyahu's room, when he was speaking to the UNGA, was mostly empty.
My name is Lita Hirschman Levy, and I'm a member of Jewish Voice for Peace. I'm disgusted that our country would allow this war criminal here. There is no reason for him to be here. He should be locked up. He should not have any power as far as I'm concerned. He is a war criminal. He is perpetuating and creating a genocide in Gaza. He is murdering thousands of Palestinians. This is not in the name of Jewish safety. It is goes against everything that Judaism stands for. I'm horrified that this is happening in my name as a Jewish person. I'm the descendant of Holocaust survivors. My grandparents were Holocaust survivors. He is not welcome here. He is a war criminal, and this has to end. Palestine needs to be free, liberated, with the right to return home.
Voices from the streets as thousands marched to the United Nations demanding the arrest of the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and an end to Israel's war on Gaza. Special thanks to Jenny Keenan and Safwat Mazal. Inside the UN, more than 100 diplomats from over 50 countries walked out in protest during Netanyahu's remarks at the General Assembly. Meanwhile, outside the UN, Colombian President Gustavo Petro joined protesters Friday, calling for an international intervention to end Israel's genocide. He also urged U.S. troops to disobey orders from President Trump.
The global force has to be bigger than that of the United States. That's why from here, from New York, I ask all of the soldiers of the Army of the U.S. not to point their guns at people. Disobey the orders of Trump. Obey the orders of humanity.
The Trump administration said Friday it had revoked President Petro's visa for joining the pro-Palestinian protest outside the UN. In response, Petro wrote online, quote, revoking it for denouncing genocide shows the U.S. no longer respects international law, unquote.
That's it for us for today. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. To listen to this episode or any previous episode again, you can go to CQUT's website at cqut.ca and click on the name of the show to see the archive. You can also find the link to this archive on CFRC's website at cfrc.ca. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.